Let's turn in our Bibles to Exodus chapter 19. In the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on the very day they came to the desert of Sinai. After they set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the house of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites." So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, "I am going to come to you in a dense cloud, so that the people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you." Then Moses told the Lord what the people had said. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Make them wash their clothes and be ready for the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, 'Be careful that you do not go up the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. He shall surely be stoned or shot through with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on him. Whether man or animal, he shall not be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they go up to the mountain.'" After Moses had gone down the mountain to the people, he consecrated them and they washed their clothes. Then he said to the people, "Prepare yourselves for the third day. Abstain from sexual relations. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently, and the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. Then Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. The Lord descended to the top of the Mount Sinai and called Moses to the top of the mountain. So Moses went up, and the Lord said to him, 'Go down and warn the people so that they do not force their way through to see the Lord, and many of them perish. Even the priests who approach the Lord must consecrate themselves, or the Lord will break out against them.' Moses said to the Lord, 'The people cannot come up Mount Sinai because you yourself warned us. Put limits around the mountain and set it apart as holy.' The Lord replied, 'Go down and bring Aaron up with you, but the priests and the people must not force their way through to come up to the Lord, or he will break out against them.' So Moses went down to the people and told them." Well, the intention this morning really is for this to be the last of the sermons on Exodus, at least for a little while. The reason for that is chapter 19 marks a sort of transition point in the book. So up to this point, the first 18 chapters details God's dealings with Israel, rescuing them from slavery in Egypt, bringing them to this mountain, as his promise was. So much of it is... Sort of narrative about events, about things that God does, about the way that the people respond. That's how the first 18 chapters of Exodus works. 19, like I say, forms a sort of a bridge into chapter 20 and following. Chapter 20 and following, famously, is the Ten Commandments, and then the unpacking of the Ten Commandments, the words that God speaks to his people. And it's a bit of a different chapter, really. It's a chapter about preparation. It's still dealing with their movements to this place, and then God speaking to them about how they're to get ready to receive his word. And I guess the question that the chapter throws up for me, the question that's been in my mind during the week as I've been thinking about this passage, is the issue of how do I think about God? How do I approach God? What does it look like for me to come near to God today, 21st century England, as a believer? What does that look like? What's that meant to be like? Can I approach God? Famously, lots of famous people would describe themselves as agnostic, meaning that they believe it is impossible to know what God is like. But the Christian message is one of revelation. God reveals himself to us so that we can know him, so we can draw near to him. That's part of what we're doing together this morning. We're coming into God's presence. But it's not just on a Sunday, and it's certainly not just in religious buildings. Every morning when I get up to pray, I'm coming into God's presence. So the question I'm asking myself this morning is, what does that look like? And what sort of attitude am I meant to have as I approach? Because there's lots here about attitude, isn't there, in this passage? What does it look like for me to draw near to God? So the historical situation, just to recap, so that we're up to speed with what's going on. The book of Exodus, set about 1300 BC, details Israel captives in the land of Egypt as slaves, and they are then they're crying out to God for rescue. God hears them, and he sends Moses to be the deliverer. Preparation from very early on, as he's a baby in a basket in the River Nile amongst the bulrushes. But then he grows up, and at the age of 80, he goes back into the country in order to speak to Pharaoh at God's command to order Pharaoh to release God's people. Pharaoh refuses. There's the 10 plagues. Eventually they go. They go through the Red Sea. And all the way through those events of the plagues, the Red Sea, and then what follows, God proves himself to be a rescuer, a God who saves, a God who loves to deliver people who are in trouble. So the events of the Red Sea, the provision of the manna and the provision of the quail, and then the provision of the water from the rock, all demonstrating God's great compassion and love towards those who call out to him, which is a great encouragement to us. That's why we're studying it, because the God of Exodus 1 to 18 is the God who still acts today, who still cares about us, the God who provides, the God who protects, the God who can be called out to. So that's the historical context. And here in chapter 19, this transitionary chapter, we have some pretty challenging words about how the people are to give up their grumbling and their moaning and draw near to God honestly. And I want to suggest there are two key things going on here that God impresses on his people. Two key things for us to learn as well about how we relate to God. The first is about obedience, and the second is about reverence. Obedience and reverence, or the need for holiness and the need for awe. And I don't think things have changed. I think that's exactly the same in many ways today. The need for reverence and the need for obedience. That's what's needed as we draw near to God. Now, it is very easy with a sermon like this to point the finger at everybody else who's not doing it as reverently as we are. Now, of course, you would never do this, but there can be that little suspicion that all other churches are not quite as good as ours because we do it properly. The way that we do our singing and the way that we do our worship, well, that's reverent, and that's full of awe and full of holiness. And you know those people down the road, I'm not thinking of anybody down the road, by the way, but you know those people down the road in that other church, whatever it is, that other denomination, they don't do it as well as we do it. Well, of course, that's nonsense, isn't it? It's actually got very little to do with style and everything to do with the heart, the response to God's words. That's the issue. And I think, just being honest about this, for many of us, obedience and reverence are in short supply. Just being honest about how we respond to God, obedience and reverence are in short supply. Well, let's dive in and see what God says. Firstly, then, relationship with God means obedience. Verse 5. If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, that's my agreement with you, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be my treasured possession. That is to say, obedience is a necessary consequence of being in relationship with God. Now, I need to explain that because people get that the wrong way around all the time. People think that in order to become a Christian, to come into relationship with God, they've got to turn their lives around and be good. That is not what this passage teaches. It is not what the Bible teaches. Obedience is not the groundwork for coming into relationship with God. It's very clear here in verse 4. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. That verse is ever so important for understanding the way that God deals with us. God isn't looking for your obedience in order for him to say, oh yes, well, Alan, he's a good man and I'll have him in my kingdom. He's been honest and reliable and faithful. I'll make him one of mine. That's not how it works. The gospel is that we're wrecked. Internally, our hearts, Jesus is very honest about this, our hearts are where all the actions come from, and our hearts are messed up. So it's not that God looks at us and says, so-and-so's got a good heart, and so-and-so's got a good heart, and I'll welcome them into my kingdom. What he does is, he calls people who are in a mess, like these people, brings them out of that into his kingdom, and then calls them as a result of that salvation to obedience. That pattern is the pattern of the Old Testament, and the pattern of the New Testament too. Salvation precedes obedience. I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. It's obviously the language of rescue. And it is the language of the rescue of the New Testament too. This Exodus story forms the basis for the New Testament rescue. The gospel authors, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, all four of them pick up on this imagery from Exodus when they're dealing with what Jesus comes to do to lead us in a second Exodus out of slavery into life in himself. And for you and I, that is dramatically achieved at the cross. We're in darkness, we're lost, without hope. And then Christ dies, and through that death brings us freedom from sin, peace with God. He brought us out of the clutches of the devil, out of the dominion of Satan and his kingdom, and into the glorious kingdom of his Son. That's what he's done in the gospel. We receive that salvation by calling out in faith to God to rescue us. We cry out for mercy. That's what it means to become a Christian. It's not saying, God, look at all these wonderful things I've done. I've been to church for 30 years. I've taught in Sunday school. I'm good with my finances. I give to charity. I give to church. That's not how we come to God. We come to God and say, I need you to rescue me. I'm in a mess. Please save me. And the gospel says, the good news says, he will answer anyone who calls out, no matter what mess they're in. These people in slavery were calling out for a very long time in Egypt, and God heard them, and he brought them out on eagle's wings. He rescued them. And he does exactly the same for us today, as we call out. But you must call out. We've got to do that. Somebody else can't do that for you. Becoming a Christian is not a corporate thing. It is an individual thing. I call out to God for rescue myself. I confess my sin and I say, please let me follow you and know you. So we come into relationship with God through Jesus Christ, through his death. And I suppose I need to ask you the question this morning, are you a Christian? Are you in relationship with God? Have you asked him to rescue you? You're not a Christian because you belong to this country, because you're in England. You're not a Christian even because you're in Hall Green Baptist Chapel. That doesn't make you a Christian. You're a Christian if you've called out for rescue. If you have, then rejoice, because he is a rescuing God and he will hear your cry. No matter what trouble you're in, he will hear your cry. Now, having understood that, we can move on to God's command. Now, if you obey me, so that's subsequent to being rescued. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations, you will be my treasured possession. You will be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. These are the words that you're to speak to the Israelites. God makes it plain here. What he requires from his people is obedience. God speaks, so we listen, we understand, and we do. We obey. He leads, so we follow. He reveals his will, so we put it into action. And the consequence of this will be the enjoyment of the covenant blessings. As they do what God says, so they will experience what it means to enjoy relationship with God. They're not brought into relationship through obedience, but they do enjoy the benefits of relationship by obedience. I was trying to think of this phrase, treasured possession. And I thought of a few different people that I know have treasured possessions. Maybe you could think about that yourself. What is it that you really couldn't do without? What thing do you really treasure the most? It might be a person, of course. Or it might be a thing. When I went to see David Campbell when we moved up here, one of the things he did was show us around his house. And David, I love David dearly. He is a dear, dear brother to me. I'll tell you what he loves. It's very obvious when you go into his house. He loves his books. I have never seen a house more full of books. It is three stories of books, essentially. And you go in and they're all neatly laid out. My library looks an absolute mess compared to his. He treasures those books. And he treasures the books, of course, not just because they're books, but because they lead him to understand God more. They're part of the way that he engages as a Christian with Christian thinking. He treasures those books and he set them out all neatly and he knows where everything is. Well, God points to Israel and says, "You are my treasure possession. I've rescued you. Walk with me and you will experience that being treasured and being loved." And the honour for these people will extend even further. They're to be a kingdom of priests. That is, they will all have access to God and proclaim his glory to other people. That's what it means to be a priest. They will be a holy nation set apart for God, specially reserved for him. Now, that's the Old Testament. That's 1300 BC. But that comes to us through the New Testament. The Apostle Peter picks up those very words and says that we have been called as Christians to be a nation of priests and a holy nation. That's us. That's our position, if you're a Christian. And then the question comes, if we are that, are we being obedient followers of this king? Do we allow his jurisdiction and rule over our lives? Or is he just somebody that we talk about on a Sunday or perhaps on a Thursday when we get together? Is it true that God's word is the measure of my life, about how I behave and what I do? Do I want to obey him as the God who rescued me and has given me life and hope? Do I seek to know his mind and will and put it into action? They're the marks of healthy relationship with God. That's what it means to be in relationship. I want to hear what he says and I want to do what he says. And the response of the people here is to be a sort of prototype for the response of a New Testament Christian, those who've come into relationship with God through Christ. Here it is, verse 8. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." Now, in New Testament terms, we think about this primarily in the way that we respond to the words that Jesus speaks to us. And I'll tell you why that is. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is very clear about listening to what he says. So he talks about Old Testament law and he says, "In the past you have heard it said, but now I say to you." So it is Jesus' words that are the fulfillment of all the Old Testament. In every way, it's Jesus' words. And he has the audacity, and the right, of course, but to say, "Listen and do my words." As God says here, God the Father in the Old Testament, "Listen and do my words." Jesus, New Testament, says, "Listen and do my words." Listen to this. This is really shocking stuff when you think about it in light of Exodus 19. Jesus speaking says, "Everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and they beat on the house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew that beat against the house. It fell, and great was the fall of it." Now, the shocking thing about that parable, I don't want to preach it now, but the standout thing about that parable is that it is perfectly possible to hear Jesus' words and still be a fool. So you can go to church or chapel as much as you like and still be a fool. The measure of whether you're a wise person, whether you're a wise person or I'm a wise person, is whether I do what Jesus says. You see how that ties in so well with Exodus 19. "I've rescued you out of Egypt, out of slavery. I've brought you into relationship with myself. You will enjoy that relationship, the covenant blessings, by obedience. Walk with me and do what I say." And then 1300 years later, Jesus comes on the scene. God come down from heaven. He says, "These are my words to you." God's words. "I am God the Son. These are the words that you need to hear and do You need to do these words. So that means, of course, Christianity can never, ever simply be about what we do on a Sunday morning for an hour. It can never just be this. It must be about everything. It must be about how I respond at work to people and how I deal with people and how I live out the gospel in that context and how I live it out in that most difficult of places, in the family, how I respond to people around me, how I watch TV, how I don't watch TV sometimes, how I speak, how I think. And Jesus is really clear about this. It is about the heart, isn't it? It's about what's going on internally. So what is Jesus saying to you at the moment, specifically? My experience of walking with Christ over the last 40 years is that there are seasons in life where he's got his finger on one particular thing and he says, this is the thing that you need to be doing, that you need to be thinking about, that you need to change. So I'm asking you this morning, what is he particularly pointing to at the moment? And some of you already know what that is. Something that God has been saying to you, that needs to change, or you need to do that thing that you weren't doing. So how are you going to respond? What are you going to do? All that the Lord has spoken, we will do. Isn't that a great response? Of course, history proves that they're not very good at doing that. What they need is a transformation of the heart. They need the new covenant. But that's the response verbally here. All that the Lord has spoken, we will do. Will you say that to Jesus? All that you said, Jesus, I'm going to do that. Secondly, relationship with God means obedience, and relationship with God means reverence. As we read through this account, we can hardly fail to notice the emphasis here on holiness. God warns his people through Moses that he's going to arrive at Sinai in power, and they're going to have to make themselves ready. They've got to be holy. The directions are very specific here. Clean clothes, which have been washed, an outward sign of holiness. The strictest of instructions about when they can go near to the mountain, and what they can and they can't touch. If anyone touches the mountain, human or animal, they're to be put to death. It's pretty blunt. Now think yourself into that situation. Take yourself back there. Think back those 3,300 years and imagine that you're in the camp just at the base of Mount Sinai. You're there in your tent. You've been there for 3 days now. Your clothes are clean. You've fulfilled all the requirements that Moses has said, and now it's time to meet with God. Imagine the anticipation. Must have been pretty terrifying. As you come out of your tent, there in front of you is Mount Sinai, towering into the sky and covered partly by this dense black cloud. Lightning flashes, thunder rumbles. The mountain is shaking. You can feel it through your feet. A huge column of smoke goes up from the top of the mountain. You can see a fire burning and descending onto the mountain. There's the sound of a trumpet getting louder and louder. There's no doubt what's happening here in Exodus 19. The awesome creator of the universe has decided to reveal himself. And you, well, what would you feel like? You would feel like nothing, wouldn't you? You would be terrified. Everything in you wants to run away, but Moses calls you to come forward, and the people together move to the base of the mountain. Then to cap it all, this tremendous voice comes out from the mountain. God speaks, and everyone hears, and he commands Moses to come up the mountain to meet him. It's very vivid imagery, isn't it? You can feel the mountain shaking, almost smell the smoke rising from Sinai. What would it be like to be that close to God? To come into his presence, visibly, audibly. So Moses goes up the mountain to meet God. The Lord again repeats his command. Verse 21, go down and warn the people so they do not force their way through to see the Lord, and many of them perish. Why does God say this twice? Well, I think the answer is to warn the people very carefully about the danger of over-familiarity. We're warned not to rush into his presence as if it's just another thing that we do. He is not a God for idle viewing or curiosity. He is not to be approached casually. Even those who have been appointed as priests in the Old Testament must make special preparation when they come before him. Why? Because God could break out in anger against them, against their sin in a moment, and destroy them. God in his absolute holiness cannot stand sin. The danger of coming near to God for any of us is that he may destroy us because of our sin. Now that is not something that you're going to hear very often said from pulpits today. You won't hear that on the radio or the TV, but Exodus is really clear. The danger of coming near to God is that he would break out and destroy us because of our sin. We, even as Christians, do not see sin for what it really is. We think it's just a thing I do or just a thing I don't do. It's a dangerous thing. It really is a terrifying thought. Our God does not change. He's still the same holy and righteous God today. And we're foolish if we think it's a small thing to come into his presence, a small thing to talk to him, a small thing to worship him. Reverence and awe are demanded by the very nature of the God who is here at Sinai. Now, to get to the heart of what's going on here, we need to move into the New Testament and have a look at a passage that describes this event and then talks about the parallel for us. So this is Hebrews. There are some differences, but there are great similarities. Let me read to you from Hebrews 12. So this is the New Testament author looking back 1,300 years ago to the events of Exodus 19. You have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further messages be spoken to them, for they could not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. But you have come to Mount Zion. So there's a contrast there between the Old Testament Mount Sinai and Mount Zion, which historically is where Jerusalem is, but here it's being used of God's heavenly home. You've come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. So you see there in Hebrews 12 the contrast in the experience. In the Old Testament, it's dark, it's terrifying, it's frightening. We don't come to that fearful mountain, the author of Hebrews tells us. It was so terrifying that he couldn't even look at it, made them tremble. No, we come to God's home, his throne, where all his glory shines and all his angels and people worship together. It's not a fearful, but a joyful picture in Hebrews 12. So that brings us a problem, doesn't it, if you're thinking and you're still awake. Does this mean that the awe and reverence that was demanded in the Old Testament in Exodus 19 isn't our application today? Does that mean that we are expected to come in a different way to God now? Has all that I've just said fallen down because of Hebrews 12? Is it different? Well, interestingly, the answer is no. This is the remarkable thing. We come to a better position than Israel because we have greater privileges because of the gospel, but the application is exactly the same. Here's Hebrews 12, 28. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe. That's the call for us today, to draw near with reverence and awe. We have access to God through Christ. We have the privilege of going right into his throne room, but always the attitude is to be one of reverence and awe. We don't just skip into God's presence as if he's our pal. To be honest, I find some of the songs that we sing, I'm not talking about here so much, but some of the songs that we sing, I find really disturbing because they are, just the language is, I think, pretty disrespectful of God. He's not to be messed with. He's awesome. We stand in awe of him. He is our Father and friend through Christ, that's certainly true, but he is creator of the world. He is holy and awesome in his might. And what does Hebrews say in the next verse? It says that our God is a consuming fire. That's why we come with reverence and awe. He is terrifying in the way that he deals with sin. There must be a sense of wonder and awe and reverence, even when we rejoice in his presence. Now, I'm going to give you a little exercise. What I'd like you to do, just for 30 seconds, you can either do this on your own if you don't like talking to other people, or you can talk to the person next to you if you fancy doing that. How do I show reverence and awe today? What am I meant to do? What does that look like, showing God reverence and awe? There you go, 30 seconds, have a think. Or talk to the person next to you if you'd like to. Can I suggest a few things that it probably isn't, if I may be so bold? I don't think it's anything to do with what you're wearing, really. Now, I know that Christians have different opinions about what's appropriate for Sunday dress, but I think that that at the very best is an outward expression of the heart and not the issue. It's not about what you wear. I don't think it's about the style of singing either, if I'm going to be honest. I do think it's about the content of the songs and the way that we express our worship to God in terms of the truths that we're singing about. But I don't think it's about whether you use a guitar or you use an organ. I don't think that's the issue. I don't think that shows reverence or no reverence. I'll tell you what I think it is. At least from Exodus 19, I think the primary way that we show reverence and awe is by obedience. I think it goes back to the first point. You either stand in awe of him and do what he says, or you don't stand in awe of him and you do what you want. There are other ways of showing reverence and awe. It is about the heart, I do understand that. It is about how I approach him, whether it's on a Sunday with all of us together or whether it's first thing in the morning when I get up and I speak to him in prayer and read his word. There's reverence and awe in the way that I approach him in that. But I think primarily the way that I show that I am in awe of this God is that I do what he says. So there's a good test if we really are in awe of him. Do I do what he says? Even when that's hard, even when that's difficult, do I do what he says?